Hello, sports fans. Welcome to this edition of Sports on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Candace Saylor, your volunteer reader. And today we have a couple articles, one, of course, about the Super Bowl, and then an interesting article as spring training approaches about the Chicago Cubs. We start today with a profile of Kansas City coach Andy Reid. It was written by Vahi Gregorian February 4th for the Kansas City Star. Andy Reid could go on for years after finding the fountain of youth in Patrick Mahomes, Miami. As the final seconds of Super Bowl 54 ticked down on Sunday at Hard Rock Stadium and Andy Reid was being swarmed, the face of the Chiefs coach became so animated and flush as to appear almost contorted. As the Chiefs completed their 31-20 victory over San Francisco to win it all for the first time in 50 years, the roaring, glowing red visage of his euphoria made for a compelling spectacle. For one shining moment, he was giddy. And it was a beautiful thing to see a man who so often urges his players to let your personality show finally uncork his own. It was a face that a guy you'd never want to play poker against almost certainly never before had allowed himself to release publicly, and of a nature that perhaps he never even had generated privately. By the time he arrived at his post-game news conference an hour or so after the game had ended, Reid displayed another look he has seldom shown in full view over the last few decades. He was without his customary eyeglasses, what with his pair repeatedly fogging up amid a celebration that included drenching and maybe even a certain mist emanating from the inside looking out. None of which is to suggest that this filter-free jubilation necessarily was the happiest moment of his life. Not for a man of faith, who, legendary work ethic notwithstanding, lives with a sense of perspective that those closest to him know is what truly defines him. He finds his fulfillment in friendships and his rewards in mentoring so many and the inherent pleasure of a canvas to create on. More substantially yet, he's filled up by fatherhood and grandfatherhood and his bond with the one who completes him. No, not Patrick Mahomes, who animates and enhances Reid's genius on the field and who is essential to Reid at last seizing the elusive Lombardi Trophy in his 21st season as a head coach, and that pinnacle that they just attained isn't the end so much as a fresh beginning. We'll get back to how Mahomes has become Reid's fountain of youth, but we're talking about his beloved wife Tammy, who is entwined with him in everything. As he playfully reminded us all early Monday morning, riffing off a question about whether he'd spent the sleepless night before with the trophy, Reid smiled and said, "I spent it with my trophy wife." So the abandon that the typically subtle and restrained Reid radiated on Sunday night was less a maximum level of ecstasy than it was a unique form of thrill, and a form that speaks to a fundamentally altered perception of Reid that illuminates a few things that were true long ago, but bear fresh focus and clarity today. For one thing, Reid is now eminently qualified to enter the Pro Football Hall of Fame in the wake of entering the stratosphere that we all expected, as NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell termed the Super Bowl breakthrough for the man he noted also has been a, quote, extraordinary help to me as commissioner. But Reid, 61, already had a terrific case. He has won the sixth most games among NFL coaches. Paul Brown appears on some lists ahead of Reid, but 52 of Brown's wins were in the All-American Football Conference before Cleveland entered the NFL. Reid has revived two franchises, starting with Philadelphia in 1999. And he's an innovator and influencer with an ever-growing coaching tree and 222 career wins. Then there's this. While it's now obvious to more people after being on display for all the world to see, Reid's relationship with Mahomes rejuvenated an already energized Reid since they had their first meeting before the 2017 NFL draft. And it's telling that when he was asked how much longer he'll coach, Reid first said that he hasn't thought about it and that he still enjoys what he's doing, before glancing towards Mahomes nearby. "I've got this young quarterback over here who makes life easy," he said. Such a pleasure, and with such chemistry between them, that it's easy to picture Reid trying to coach Mahomes as many years as he can. Shoot, who's to say that if each stays healthy, Reid, who turns 62 in March, might not try to coach Mahomes his whole career? In the hardest days of his life in 2012, after his son Garrett had died, and Reed, less significantly, was on his way to losing his job in Philly, football was part of Reed's way forward as he took the job in Kansas City. It's only logical to think that he'll want to do this as long as he can, amid such prosperity and potential, which could set a stage for the ultimate collaboration, both entering the Hall of Fame at once. Sure, that's presumptuous in many ways, even after Mahomes led the Chiefs to the championship in unprecedented fashion in the Super Bowl era with three straight postseason rallies from double digits down. But Mahomes is on a promising initial trajectory after becoming the youngest player to have won both an NFL MVP last season and a Super Bowl, as well as the youngest man to win the Super Bowl MVP, 24 years and 138 days old that day. Certainly, Reed figures Mahomes is on his way to the Hall. When he was asked last Sunday if he would finally publicly unveil his imitation of Mahomes' voice, which Reed has called froggish, Reed laughingly said, I'll get that to you when he's inducted into the Hall of Fame. In the meantime, the impact of Mahomes on Reed is almost tangible. Reed offered a snapshot of that when he was asked for the zillionth time about what he saw early on in Mahomes and gushed in an entirely new way. With some fresh flourishes, Reed retold the tale of how general manager Brett Veach, then the Chiefs' co-director of player personnel, had told him Mahomes was the best player he'd ever seen, and he wore him out by playing videos. Over time, Reed found himself agreeing with that pretty bold statement about the prospect from Texas Tech, but he maintained a healthy skepticism. Then you go, well, let's see how he does this in the NFL. He can't do all that stuff, Reed said. Then he came to us and started doing all that stuff. And then some, in his own inimitable way as a great leader with the innate ability to make everyone around him better. He sees the field, which I appreciate. You say, well, all quarterbacks see the field. No, they don't. Not like he does, Reed said, later adding, after a bit, you're thinking, this guy's unbelievable. He can take it all in. He challenges you as a coach to give him more, so his aptitude is ridiculous. And so as a coach, you love that. You're able to feed him new plays, and he gobbles those things up and makes them look even better than they did on paper. When Reed said that, it reminded me of something I'd stumbled upon when I was thinking about their relationship and whether it resembled that of a composer and a performer. In the process, I came across an essay on a Stanford website attributed to Samuel Feinberg, a renowned Russian composer and pianist. It seemed to have an uncanny application to Reed's creative play designing and Mahomes' engagement of them, something we already have a sense of in two visionaries who are completing each other's sentences. The composer needs an intermediary performer, a creative interpreter of his composition, Feinberg wrote, adding that at a certain point, the artist is not an executor of another's will. Rather, the mind of the composer should become the performer's own and blend with the individual traits of his talent, with his own artistic aspirations. The performer gains strength and courage in this unity, which is necessary for the concrete realization and sound of the ideas and images contained in the work. Sounds familiar when it comes to a relationship that Mahomes says thrives because Reed knows the right time to kind of rein me in, but at the same time lets me be who I am. It happens sometimes that a composer is unable to take into account all of the technical, colorific, and expressive possibilities of a master instrumentalist, the essay continued. Sometimes a composer trusts the performer to introduce some changes into the text. Such a friendly collaboration may help the author find a path to the most grateful exposition, end quote. A destination they seem to reach on Sunday, which turns out only to be the impetus for more, thanks to the revamping of a defense to complement Mahomes and a galaxy of offensive stars surrounding him. When Reed was asked Monday morning about the play inspired by tape from the 1948 Rose Bowl, he smiled and said, "We actually have a whole package of it, so you'll have to wait until next year to see the rest." Bringing a whole new meaning to wait until next year. For all the joy Reed let loose on Sunday, the best might still be ahead. And now, with the NFL season having come to an end, we're going to turn our attention a little bit to Major League Baseball, specifically the Cubs, in this article by Patrick Mooney and Shadiv Sharma, February 4th from TheAthletic.com. Believe it or not, the Cubs are undergoing a major transformation. What effect will it have? Joanne DeVries, 95, died January 19th at her apartment in a retirement community in East Moline, Illinois. Her obituary described her as a devout Catholic, a singer in the church choir, a volunteer at a local hospital and blood bank, a pinochle player, and the funniest old woman on Facebook, despite never having gone on the internet herself. DeVries is survived by 9 grandchildren and 16 great-grandchildren, plus a coming attraction. She lived, in so many ways, a full life. The final line of her death notice would be read far beyond the Quad Cities. Quote, "Donations in Joanne's memory may be directed toward the impoverished Ricketts family of Chicago, Illinois, for purposes of assembling a near-major league-caliber bullpen, or to be dispersed per family wishes." What a way to sum up another lost offseason for the Cubs and their fans' simmering frustrations with just about everything. Ownership's focus on the luxury tax, the marquee TV network versus Comcast, the Chris Bryant trade rumors, no leadoff hitter, and the bullpen, always the bullpen. The team staged its 35th annual Cubs convention on the same weekend that DeVries died. On a frigid gray Saturday morning in January, President of Baseball Operations Theo Epstein and General Manager Jed Hoyer sat through a Q&A session with fans at the Sheraton Grand Chicago. At that point in the offseason, the Cubs had not yet signed a free agent to a fully guaranteed major league contract. "In general, I think what most fans focus on, and rightfully so, is major league transactions over the winter," Hoyer told the audience inside the hotel ballroom. "So much of our job is taken up not only on major league transactions, but also making sure that we have the right infrastructure to support everything in baseball. In some ways, this has probably been our most active winter that we've ever had." After the Cubs dismissed Joe Maddon following a second consecutive September collapse, all of their messaging suggested sweeping changes would be coming to Wrigley Field. And not just cutting ties with the yoga instructor and the massage therapist and rearranging the organizational chart. Cubs fans dreaming up blockbuster trades and scanning the lists of free agents didn't think the biggest additions by Super Bowl Sunday would be outfielder Steven Souza Jr., $1 million, and reliever Jeremy Jeffress, $850,000, two buy-low players who could turn out to be valuable contributors or funny names to remember 5 years down the line. This doesn't excuse the all-budget-conscious decisions that have gone into the 2020 roster or minimize all the risk the Cubs will carry during the season. It doesn't guarantee that all those theoretical plans will work and reboot the Cubs as a scouting and player development machine. But a deeper look reveals that the Cubs have transformed their baseball operations department, even if a familiar group of players reports to spring training in Arizona. We're at the halfway point of our show today, so I'm going to remind you that you're listening to Sports on Sunsounds of Arizona. Now back to our article. From the new manager, David Ross, to the new farm directors, Matt Dorey and Bobby Basham, to the new vice president of scouting, Dan Kantrowitz, to the new directors of hitting, Justin Stone, and pitching, Craig Breslow, to the World Series or bust expectations, these aren't the same old Cubs. "We looked at things and decided that the game is moving incredibly fast when it comes to player development, when it comes to research and development," Hoyer said. "I know those aren't the transactions you guys want when you pick up the paper every day, but I think that you're going to see really exceptional dividends on those hires over the course of the next few years." The Cubs didn't just hire more people who used to work for the Red Sox. Of course, when you're applying to work for the baseball operations department, it helps to have a Boston connection, an Ivy League or New England private college education, and your own baseball reference page. Breslow, for instance, has a 2013 World Series ring from the Red Sox and a Yale University degree in molecular biophysics and biochemistry. But increasingly, teams are looking outside of professional baseball for new talent and different ideas. Major League Baseball had been sort of developing baseball players the same way for 100 years, Epstein said. And then these little private institutions, little labs, popped up. Stone, who had been a biokinematic hitting consultant for the Cubs the last 2 years, founded Elite Baseball Training, a cutting-edge facility near the WGN studios 2 miles west of Wrigley Field. In the same unassuming office park where parents would drop off their young kids for baseball or soccer lessons, Stone built the hitting equivalent of Driveline Baseball, the pitching-slash-tech lab outside of Seattle. The Cubs hired a Driveline instructor, Casey Jacobson, to be their new coordinator of pitching development. He worked last year as an assistant coach at Augustana University in South Dakota, following 5 seasons as the pitching coach for McAllister College in Minnesota. James Ogden, the organization's new coordinator of pitching performance, joined the Cubs after 7 seasons as the pitching coach for Lipscomb University in Tennessee. The Cubs will have a lead hitting coach and an assistant hitting coach at every level of their minor league operation this season, all the way from AAA Iowa to the Dominican Summer League. One hitting coach will have more expertise with data, while the other will handle more of the typical duties assigned to a hitting coach. Those new hires include coaches who spent last season outside the traditional structure of professional baseball. Class A South Bend hitting coach Dan Puente worked with Stone as an instructor at Elite Baseball and Training. Will Skett, the assistant hitting coach for Class A Myrtle Beach, was the head coach at Faith Baptist High School in California. Travis Fitta, the assistant hitting coach for Class A Eugene, was the director of hitting development at Ohio University. The Mesa Cubs will feature pitching coaches who left the University of Arkansas, Doug Wally, and Westmont College, Tony Cagoule, as well as a trailblazing assistant hitting coach, Rachel Folden, the owner of her own facility in Indiana, and a former professional softball player. As Epstein said, youth players and amateur players in college programs started to dive in and embrace that stuff, looking for advantages, while MLB just continued on in some respects the way it had always been done. And I think we have to recognize when we're wrong. The Cubs were already moving in this direction 1 year ago when they hired Adam Beard to be their director of high performance, drawing upon his experience with the Cleveland Browns, the Welsh Rugby Union, and with Olympic athletes. At the Cubs convention, Hoyer said the team is adding a longtime NASA employee to be its biomechanics expert. In a post-Moneyball world, studying the body is the next frontier. When I started in baseball, said Epstein, who joined the San Diego Padres as a PR assistant 25 years ago, statistical analysis was really just looking at performance, the results that players would get, and trying to predict future performance based on the results, batting average and on-base percentage and slugging percentage. And then it moved to, well, okay, what's contributing to the results? What are the underlying indicators to produce those results? You look at exit velocity and launch angle and those things. And then in recent years, it's really gone to, what is the body doing? What are the components of the swing and of the delivery that produce the indicators that go on to produce results? It's being measured at the very granular level in a scientific way. So now we're gearing all of our training, all of our high-performance strength and conditioning work with our players to produce the type of bodies and physiology and movements that can produce great results. It's like we're reverse engineering what goes into an effective swing or an effective delivery and then trying to train for it. Amid the homegrown pitching shortage that forced them to spend hundreds of millions of dollars and valuable trade chips on starters and closers, the Cubs hired Breslow to evaluate the entire system last year. As a 26th-round pick who spent parts of 12 seasons in the big leagues and used emerging technology to reinvent himself and lengthen his career, Breslow had a unique point of view. Now he's in an influential position where he can implement those ideas. While Breslow spent the 2019 season observing what the Cubs were doing across the organization, he naturally gravitated toward pitching. He had the ability to see things through the lens of a recently removed pitcher and as someone looking at the interests of the organization holistically, which are not always the easiest perspectives to reconcile. To Breslow, this was not about identifying the holes within the Cubs' process or what needed to be changed. Rather, he looked at his new role as an opportunity to create a vision for how the Cubs should run, independent of how things were done previously. Whether they were far from that way of doing things, or close enough that only minor tweaks were needed, was irrelevant. It was about finding a way that they could all agree would be the best. The general pitching development philosophy now is that the lower levels of the minor leagues are about raising a player's ceiling. The view is, who are we to suggest what this player's ceiling is? Instead of assuming limitations, push that player in various ways and see if you can raise that ceiling. Once those pitchers reach the upper levels, the focus then shifts to reaching that ceiling and fine-tuning every aspect of that player's game. The pitcher is then ready to build a routine and really dig into the concepts like sequencing and tunneling. The game is constantly evolving. The Cubs can't just buy more cameras and accumulate new data. They need to have the right teachers in place to communicate expectations and explain the information. That's part of the reason why Breslow spearheaded a plan to eliminate the concept of a singular minor league pitching coordinator. He pushed for more specialization for each individual coordinator and coach. In Breslow's mind, having one pitching coordinator was an antiquated idea. One person with so many responsibilities only has so much bandwidth. In order to ensure that the various messages don't get lost in translation or slip through the cracks, delegation of tasks will be imperative. Breslow has hired or shuffled existing coaches and given them more focused roles. Mike Mason, for example, will concentrate on relievers as the assistant coordinator for pitching performance. With distinct areas to monitor, each coordinator can truly own that aspect of player development. By creating this structure, the Cubs, in theory, should be able to better guide their coaches and the implementation of their individualized player plans. The pitching infrastructure is now viewed as a big cognitive wheel. Ideally, nobody is spread too thin or is too ego-driven to not connect with the other staffers who may have a deeper insight or a better understanding of a particular concept or group of players. These specialists are supposed to open the lines of communication and help everyone work more efficiently. Ross will be the one second guest for this or that decision in the seventh inning and will answer the questions after games. But how the Cubs collaborate and put all these pieces together will determine if the bullpen becomes a success or a failure in 2020. We have to improve, Dory said. We haven't drafted or developed the pitching. Everybody's been transparent about that. But I do think that we're starting to see that turn. And with the new development infrastructure in place, we're really excited about the guys that we currently have. We can really extract more out of them and be aggressive with some of these other minor league free agents and feel like we can buy low and really hit on some guys. For all of their accomplishments in Chicago, winning the 2016 World Series, renovating Wrigley Field, modernizing the franchise's operations, the Ricketts family has had a complicated relationship with Cubs fans for a variety of reasons. But any thorough assessment of this ownership group, the good and the bad, has to recognize that Chairman Tom Ricketts pays attention to player development and doesn't look for the quick fix. Since the end of the 2013 season, when the Cubs started making initial hires for the organization's new research and development department, the team has tried to push the envelope. For the 2014 season, the R&D staff had grown to 6 people. By the end of the 2019 season, that group had expanded to 15 analysts and developers. More hires this offseason pushed that number to around 20 staffers. To get up to speed with the R&D department and immerse himself in baseball operations, Ross made extended visits to the Wrigley Field office building this offseason. He also turned over roughly half of Madden's staff, hiring a new group of coaches. While data-driven development is rapidly engulfing the sport, the Cubs insist that they haven't forgotten about the human element. Epstein and his front office envisioned Ross as a manager because of his people skills and the intangible qualities he brings to the ballpark. The relationship that the managers, coaches, and coordinators build with players at all levels of the organization are still essential, but that means Ross will have to catch up in certain areas. I'm not the smartest guy in the room, Ross said. I've got a lot of guys who are going to help me be a lot smarter and look a lot smarter. That's what I'm going to depend on. I'm going to rely on the guys who interact with me, push me, make me better. This is the 9th year of the Epstein administration, which means some employees have left for obvious promotions or better personal situations or over philosophical differences. This overhaul will impact everything from how the Cubs evaluate prospects, train players, and treat injuries. Beyond the coaches who followed Madden to the Angels, a wave of departures began last season. Change for the sake of change is a dangerous idea. Two of the most dynamic players in the organization, Javier Baez and Wilson Contreras, were signed as teenagers by Jim Hendry's group and easily could have been discarded during the early stages of Epstein's rebuild. Camp Rossi will be different, but don't fall for all the easy stories in spring training about how the Cubs are running a tight ship now. Madden's methods have worked so well for so long that he will be in the Hall of Fame someday, and his Cooperstown speech will be a doozy. Right now, this is all in theory. It's a lot easier to talk about in a conference room than execute when people are keeping score. What looks good on a laptop doesn't always translate to the field. Ready or not, it's time for a new Cubs way. We just know where the game's going and where it's trending, Dory said. It's moving really quick. There's so much opportunity out there to try to gain a competitive advantage. I think we just had to take a step back, take a deep breath, and really evaluate where we were at. I think it's more about making sure we're the leader and not the follower. We've reached the end of our show for today. Thank you for listening to Sports on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is Candace Ayler, your volunteer reader. Did you know you can listen to this and most other SunSounds programs at your convenience with On Demand? Go to sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio.